States,
Good morning, may it please the court. Article 7 of the treaty does not mandate book-based taxation and therefore does not force the United States to accept a foreign bank's funding at the U.S. branch bulked up and no capital. Instead, the treaty permits the United States to adjust the branch books to reflect the profits that might be expected if the branch was separate from independent enterprise, and a separate independent enterprise would not expect to be funded with all debt. No independent bank operates without capital. And by taxing the branch on a separate enterprise basis, the treaty in effect puts foreign banks and domestic banks on equal footing tax wise. Now, the Court of Federal Claims' reliance on the 1994 UK manual to permit NatWest to claim.
Which decision of the Court of Federal Claims?
I'm sorry.
We have three of them.
That's
Nat
true.
One, Nat Two, and Nat
Three. This is in reference to Nat Two and Nat Three, where the court adopted the UK manual and it applied the UK manual in the Nat West Three decision. But its reliance on that manual to permit Nat West to claim more interest expense than it could if it were a separate entity, that only provides Nat West an unfair advantage over U.S. domestic banks.
Are you giving up on that one?
Giving up on what one?
The Nat One decision?
No, not at all.
Because if you convince us to overturn that one, then that two and that three really.
That's
back,
correct.
Right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So why don't we focus on that one, for instance?
Sure. Well, in that one, the court did recognize that it's permissible under the treaty to adjust capital on the branch books. And the treaty does not dictate any particular capital attribution method. We think both of our methods, in this case, the reg and the corporate yardstick, are consistent with the treaty, properly interpreted and with due regard to the U.S. consistent interpretation. But the regulation is consistent with the treaty because nothing in the plain language of the treaty precludes the regulation in this case. For the most part, the Court of Federal Claims is relying on the commentary, at least the commentary, to strike down the regulation.
But the treaty itself doesn't affirmatively endorse it. So don't we really have to, though, Ms. Hagen, take a look at the extant materials at the time, the treaty, the draft convention, the commentary, the OECD commentary, the actions of the UK around that time up to 1980, and the actions of the government up to that time? Aren't those, leaving aside for the moment whichever way they cut, aren't those the most pertinent materials to the issue before us with respect to Nat 1, as Judge Garrison was pointing to?
Well, certainly, you can look at all those. Courts will look at the views of the treaty partner. Courts will look at the OECD materials. But the most important thing, after you look at the plain language of the treaty, is the government, the United States, consistent interpretation. It's that interpretation that's entitled under the Supreme Court case law to substantial deference and is given great weight, even if it conflicts with the treaty and the treaty partners' interpretation. And in my mind, that's the biggest error in that list one, is the court really disregarded the U.S. consistent interpretation. Revenue ruling after revenue ruling, technical explanation, technical after technical explanation. The United States was of the view that the regulation was consistent with Article 7. Not only that, not only the consistent interpretation, but we negotiated treaty after treaty on that basis, and the Senate ratified treaty after treaty on that basis, and the court below, in the NatWest 1 decision, ignored that.
What if you have a situation where you have one treaty partner saying X, the other treaty partner saying Y, and they're both of them have arguments of merit. This is a close case, it's a well-briefed case on both sides, and both sides have some good points, but what if we have a case where UK says one thing, US says the other, then don't we really just have to dig in and look at the treaty and the commentary?
That is true. I mean, it gets down to what he said, she said. Under the case law, as long as the US interpretation is not precluded by the treaty language, it should be referred to. We cited a case in our reply brief, the Sullivan case, where the court deferred to the U.S. interpretation of the treaty partner, and I believe it was the U.K. in that case, it's an older case, disagreed.
Is this similar to a Chevron type of deference that we have to give?
It's similar, but it is, but I believe it's even stronger because it's in the context of foreign policy, in the foreign policy area, the deference owed to the executive branch is at its highest.
Even though it might be in conflict with the commentaries at a particular time.
That would be the case, but it's not, in fact, in conflict with the commentary. See, the OSCE commentary, in our view, supports the regulation in this case because it gave a fair reading of it. It really gives treaty partners a lot of leeway to adjust the books, including, it says, quote, all methods to fight tax avoidance, which is one of the purposes of the 1.882-5 reg, as the court below recognized, that it didn't follow that to its logical conclusion under the commentary. There's nothing in the commentary that mandates recognizing interbranch transactions, as the court seemed to think, and there's nothing in the commentary that precludes using a formula to adjust branch books. So,
was the draft convention a basis for the? And you're referring to the draft convention and the commentary with respect to the draft convention, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Was the draft, this party seemed to agree, correct me if I'm wrong, that the draft convention was the starting point for the treaty negotiations. Is that correct? I mean, they seem to be working from that. Is that?
They are working from that. There is a difference in the U.S.-UK treaty from the draft convention.
Oh, yeah.
There's the reasonable allocation of interest expense language in Article 7.3 of the U.S. Treaty, which I read at the time, when they saw that, said, they're putting that in there for the express purpose of permitting U.S. expense allocation regulations. And that brings up another important point, is what were the party's actual expectations at the time that the treaty was signed?
So you agree, though, the key period here is, it's easy, up to, the most important period is up to 1980.
The most important period is
the
signing of the treaty and then what happened for 1975 to 1980 period, but that doesn't preclude looking at things that happened afterwards to shed light on the expectations when the parties signed the treaty. But the expectations when the parties signed the treaty, in this case in 1975, was that both treaty partners had allocation formula. They were using
that. We do have, though, the UK, and correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't the UK in, I don't know, I think it's around 78 or so, doesn't the UK abandon the PW formula?
That is correct. They revised their views on what's permitted under under Article 7, but that they'd already signed the treaty. They didn't try to negotiate a new protocol, and so that can't really our expectations that when we tried to sign the treaty that we were going to be able to use our regulation. In 1978, that same year, we issued a revenue ruling that made clear that we were going to be applying this regulation to foreign banks under OECD-based treaties.
But the dropping of the PW formula by the UK, was that an indication that maybe the treaty did not allow
it? Well, they didn't tell us about that, but that was their view, internal view, after they had signed the treaty.
There was not in compliance with the treaty.
There was not, well, it was actually not in compliance with the older treaty. It was the 1945 U.S.-UK treaty. But it was still our expectation and our consistent interpretation that the regulation was permitted by the treaty. And it appears that the UK has revised its views yet again, because the new legislation that they enacted permits allocating capital on the basis of either a formula that looks to the capital ratio of the bank as a whole.
That's in 2001.
That's correct, but what we quote in our brief on page 68 that they said, we're looking at the language of Article 7 and we believe that it's wide enough to permit these allocation formulas or a comparability standard like the corporate yardstick, but that we didn't have a domestic law taking up our treaty rights. And so therefore, you know, after 1978, we're going to sort of abandon our treaty rights and want to get in line with the United States and the rest of the OECD nations.
Does it make any difference that the corporate yardstick only took into account domestic banks and not international impacts of domestic banks?
I don't think so. I think when you're trying to figure out how to adjust Branch's books to figure out how much capital, there's really two places you could look. You could look at the Branch is actually relying on the worldwide capital. So you could look at the capital ratio of the bank as a whole, or you could look at what other banks were doing in the area where the permanent establishment is, and that's where the domestic banks part of the equation comes in.
But here you're dealing with a bank which is not really a domestic bank in the sense that they're retail bankers. They're wholesale bankers for the most part. So they don't deal with the mom and pop type of accounts.
I see what you're saying. That goes to the question of whether the banks that the United States actually chose were comparable or not.
Exactly.
And that is the focus of NatWest's argument against the corporate yardstick here. And as proposed, we're looking for our comparable banks. And the question is, if you could find comparable banks, would such a standard be consistent with the treaty? Whether those banks are in fact comparable or not raises a factual issue that could not and was not decided on summary judgment. If you were to decide to remand this case to the Court of Federal Claims on the basis of the corporate yardstick, NatWest at that point would be free to make its arguments the banks weren't comparable, and therefore the yardstick didn't work.
But that was one of the reasons why you were turned down for the discovery proceeding, right? Because you were trying to discover additional factors to make that argument?
No, that was after the corporate yardstick was rejected in NatWest 2, and the court said, The court said, you are limited to whatever capital has actually been given to this bank. That's all you can adjust for. You can't adjust for separate enterprise hypothetical capital. It was at that point that we said, well, we'd like to discover what capital the Home Office is actually on its books allotted to this bank. And the court said, well, no, you can only look at the Branch books under the manual, which is incorrect. The manual says you can look at both Home Office books and the Branch books.
Correct me if I'm wrong. The way I understand it, you have no problems with the deductions of interest made to third parties. It's only the issue of deductibility of the interest made to interrelated banks within the NatWest family. Make a determination as to whether or not it's a capital allocation or incentive.
Well, let me put it this way. If NatWest was totally funded by third-party loans, there would still need to be an allocation of capital because no bank can operate without any capital whatsoever. Factually, that's not the case here. It looks like a lot of their loans are coming from inter-branch loans as well as third-party loans. So what the regulation does is it disregards the inter-branch loans that are not used to generate third-party assets.
Party.
Loans, exactly.
Want to say anything?
I would. Thank you.
Mr. Wise, I always like to have somebody wise.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
In a moment.
May it please the court. Your honors are correct that the issue presented by this case is the proper construction of this 1975 treaty between the US and the UK, and what the treaty provides as a common measure of profits for use in taxing the branch here in the US. Now, and as I'm sure you realize, it's important to realize how this treaty works. It prescribes a common measure of profits of the US branch of NatWest on which the US is permitted to tax the branch. It also obligates the UK to give a tax credit for that tax based on the same measure of profits. And it's through that mechanism of having a common measure that both taxing authorities agree to, one taxing, one credit of the tax, that double tax is avoided. That is the whole purpose of the treaty. Now, the government's argument proceeds on a surprising premise that the treaty doesn't provide a common measure of profitability in the U.S. branch, and that they're free, as a result of the treaty not providing such a measure, to do what they like in attributing capital, in disallow deductions. But the premise of their argument would mean, by implication, that the treaty has essentially failed of its most important purpose, which is to avoid double tax by creating a common expectation between the two taxing parties of how the profits are to be measured. So let me just start out by giving a little bit of context, and I know your honors understand this already. The treaty in the case is 32 years old. It doesn't exist anymore. It's been superseded. There's a new treaty in the UK. The commentary, as your honor was mentioning, and the model convention that this treaty was based on come from 1963, over 40 years ago. The tax years in the case are over 20 years old. They're in the mid-80s, 81 to 87. And the central question is evaluating the mutual understanding of the treaty partners, as you were putting it, with the appropriate materials at that time.
Excuse me for jumping in on
you,
but time is fleeting. Do you agree that the key period here is up to 1980? That seems to me to be the...
Yes.
In order to determine the intention of the parties.
Yes, I do agree with that. And just while we're on that point, what we have from the U.S. during that point, on the reg that existed in 1977, for instance, providing for allocation of expenses, etc., the reg specifically recites that treaty agreements prevail over the reg. So that was in the mix of information at the time. And you're right to focus on that time period because, as you might imagine, in the 30 years since this treaty was negotiated and signed, the policy debate about how the best way to go about doing this has continued. And the OECD has continued talking about it, and tax economists have gotten involved, and bank regulators have gotten involved, and the bank regulatory world has changed dramatically. And today, there are different agreements being negotiated between countries. Indeed, there's a different agreement between the U.S. and the U.K.
Ms. Haley, I think, would seem to agree that up to 80 is the most important.
Well, much of their briefing, anyway, uses material from these further evolutions of the discussion, in fact, through the 90s, and even as recently as, you know, this year, last year, and the year before that, as somehow bearing on the central meaning of this 1975 agreement. We don't think that's right. We think that's an inappropriate and really not illuminating method of approaching the construction of this 1975 treaty.
Well, sometimes, though, the subsequent determinations could be very helpful in saying, well, this is what we meant back then. This is the reason why we're changing it now. So it does have some kind of...
I suppose it could, but the nature of this discussion has been... proceeded over a 30-year period as the banking business changed, as the bank regulatory environment changed, Basel Accords about bank regulatory environments in the late 80s, and more sophisticated, perhaps, techniques at evaluating the economics of the situation and actually applying it in some way that's workable. But that wasn't all present in 1975. And in 1975, when the parties agreed to this contract, as you will see, they agreed to what was billed at the time as a straightforward, common sense, highly practical way to measure profits in the branch that would work in the real world.
That one, Judge Gaiarsa's point. There is a doctrine in contract law that when you're looking to determine what the correct construction of a contract term is, you look to the conduct of the parties during the period of the contract as evidence of how they construed it. Now, do you think that that has any merit here, that sort of an approach has any merit in the setting of how the parties construed a treaty?
Certainly, and on the UK side, the point you earlier mentioned is perfectly appropriate to look at. In 1978, based on a legal opinion, the UK authorities decided that they did not have authority to impute notional capital. The US branches U.S. bank branches operating in the U.K. Clearly evidence that they thought the treaty prevented that from happening. And they continued to tax U.S. branches operating in the U.K. in that fashion throughout this period. On the U.S. side, as I said before, you have a 77 reg that says that provides the mechanics for allocation and notional capital, but that expressly says treaties are superior to this when they exist. And you have another reg that comes out in 1981 that's silent on the role of treaties. And it's not until 1989, all those years later, 14 years later after the treaty was signed, that this government, for the first time, asserts that 882.5, the formulaic approach to this, can be used.
So I thought you see it.
And that is after all the events in question.
Let me ask just one. And this is the same, I think I asked Ms. Hagen this question. If you have a situation where you have two parties to a treaty, it's a bilateral treaty, you have one party says a provision means X, the other party says it means Y. And they both have some arguments in their favor. And, you know, what do we do in that kind of a situation?
The cases are pretty clear on this. Indeed, the Xerox case from this court not too long ago demonstrates the proper approach here. That is, the role of the court is to construe the treaty according to the shared expectations of the parties, much like contract construction, contract interpretation. And because of that, these pleas for deference from the U.S. government are not supported in the cases. You're not meant to give blind deference to one treaty partner's view over the other. You are supposed to construe the contract in a way that implements the shared expectations of the party, and most importantly, in a way that implements the purpose of the agreement. That, if you look at the Xerox case, the Sumitomo case in the Supreme Court, the most famous Maximov case from the Second Circuit and then the Supreme Court, that is the role of the court in interpreting the treaty, to find and construe it in light of the shared expectations of the parties, and to implement the purpose of the treaty according to that shared expectation. The government's position in this case, as I've said, by implication, is that the treaty essentially fails of its central purpose because there's no measure of profits prescribed in the treaty. And yet the treaty depends to function on an agreed measure of profits for one taxing jurisdiction to tax the profits and the other taxing jurisdiction to credit the tax paid in the other jurisdiction.
The complication in this particular case because it's a banking operation rather than manufacturing.
Yes, of course. Well, that's the central problem here, is that unlike a manufacturing operation, money is the inventory in this business.
Well, money is fungible, too.
Yes, but in this business, it is inventory. It is bought and sold, just like in the manufacturing business. Now, the government's regulation as applied to this banking business, I'll put it this way. They're happy to tax the income generated from this highly sophisticated corporate lending business that NatWest was in the U.S. But they disallow the expenses associated with borrowing that money to loan it to NatWest customers. In the manufacturing context, this would be...
That's not necessarily correct, though, Mr. White, is it?
Yes.
They're allowing third-party capital coming in to be charged as an expense.
Not true. 882.5, the regulation at issue in the facts of this case, first of all, facially disregards all intra-bank transactions. But then it goes on through the use of this artificial capital ratio concept applying to a notional balance sheet that it creates. It, on the facts of this case, disallows deductions for expenses actually incurred by NatWest in paying interest to third parties for the funds that NatWest used to loan to its corporate customers.
That's because of the notional formula.
Yes. It eliminates, through the use of that arbitrary capital ratio, which it then applies to the balance sheet, it in effect imputes capital. And on the facts of this case, in every year in question, disallows deductions for interest payments, interest expense payments paid, actually paid to third parties.
But from a practical standpoint, isn't there some kind of a capital base that you would need in the bank, even though it's a wholesale banker?
Well, the business was highly profitable. I wanted to make that point. Over the years in question, the books and records kept by this business, which were highly sophisticated computerized books and records, showed $140 million of profit made in the U.S. The government's regulation, and coincidentally perhaps also their litigation position using this constructive corporate yardstick reach a different result on measuring profitability, more than doubling the profitability shown on the books of the branch. So 882.5, when applied to this branch, doubles the profits that the U.S. is seeking to tax. And just coincidentally, their litigation corporate yardstick, as they call it, achieves exactly the same result, doubling the profitability shown on the books, doubling the taxes payable in the U.S.
Going back to your inventory aspect, the analysis there, I think that's very helpful, because if you have inventory which you bring in from third parties and that costs you money to maintain, that's deductible.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
If it comes from the interbank flow, that's where the government says part of it is deductible, part of it is not.
Yes, and that's
based
where...
upon formula. Why is that incorrect?
Because the treaty requires the taxing jurisdiction to respect the transactions of the branch. The treaty at its very core adopts this so-called separate accounts principle. That is basically, you look at the operation separately, you make sure that it's dealing on an arm's length basis with the rest of the bank. You can adjust for that, but you look at the operation separately, you respect the well-kept books and records of the branch in doing that. And the commentary could not be clearer on this. Let me just give you the language. Quote from the commentary. The profits to be attributed to the permanent establishment are those which the permanent, that's the branch in the language of the treaty.
Where are you reading?
This is from 2556 in the appendix. It's the commentary that goes along with the 63 model convention used for the 75 treaty. The profits to be attributed to the branch are those which the branch would have made if, instead of dealing with its head office, it had been dealing with an entirely separate enterprise under conditions and at prices prevailing in the ordinary market. Normally, this would be the same profit that one would expect to be reached by the ordinary process of good business accountancy. In the great majority of cases, therefore, trading accounts of the branch, which are commonly available, if only because a well-run business organization is normally concerned to know what its profitability is of its various branches, will be used by the taxation authorities concerned to ascertain the profit properly attributable to the establishment. So it's clear when you look at the treaty materials, the treaty is opting for this separate accounts mechanism. And it doesn't really matter to the taxpayer, you know, 30 years later, whether they have a more sophisticated, they think is a better policy approach to measuring profitability. That's fine. But what's important to the taxpayer is that there's a shared expectation and an agreement between the two taxes. They can agree on any way to measure the profitability, but the only way to avoid double tax is to make sure that agreement stays in place and that the taxing authority is using the same measure of profits as the crediting authority is in crediting the taxpayer in the other jurisdiction. That's the way to avoid the risk of double taxation. On the point about disallowance of actual expenses paid to third parties, it's a little complicated, but it is in the appendix at page 10291-92, which is the revenue agent's report on the bank in the years in question. And you can see how the application of 882.5, as against the balance sheet that the bank actually had and then the reconstructed balance sheet under the regulation, actually works to eliminate, disallow, millions of dollars of actual interest expense payments made to third parties. In any event, I know my time is up.
Is there a procedure for asking, but still trying to figure out the aspects of accounting. The local enterprise has its own books and records. Within those local books and records, are the interbank loans accounted for within those books and records, or are they kept separate?
No. The evidence was undisputed on this point, and indeed in NatWest 3, Judge Firestone's opinion, which has not been appealed, you can read the undisputed fact. This branch was operated as a completely independent entity. It was a highly professional wholesale banking operation involved in the markets in the United States, constantly buying and selling funds, constantly buying and selling securities to generate funds or to loan funds. They dealt with counterparties in that very active marketplace completely independently, just as they did with counterparties who happened to be other elements of the NatWest Bank. And the evidence on that is completely, really undisputed, and Judge Firestone so found in an opinion that has not been appealed. So,
you think that's clear?
Definitely clear. And the reason is obvious. They wanted to measure how profitable their branch was. They paid, they compensated their employees in the U.S. based on how profitable the branch was. It was important to them to have an accurate measure of how profitable the branch was on an independent basis. And the accounting systems achieved exactly that in the bank. I'm sorry I'm out of time. I would just like to reemphasize that deference point. The government is not entitled to the deference it seeks here. If you look at the treaty cases, that's clear, and particularly in light of the interpretation for which they are seeking deference, which interpretation would, in, by implication, mean that the treaty has centrally failed in its purpose of common understanding. Thank you very much, Governor.
Okay, we have some time left.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just from about a few points raised by counsel for the bank. First of all, there is no specific method in the treaty for implementing a separate enterprise principle. As the Supreme Court noted in the Container Court case, which we cited in our reply brief, Article 7.2 is merely a general outline leaving to the different countries to use different precise rules to implement. Article 7.2 doesn't spell any particular method. It certainly doesn't say follow the branch books. It's just a standard against which to measure other methods. And that's why, in fact, the OECD, recognizing that all these different countries are applying all these different methods, creating instances where double taxation may occur, has been working hard to develop a consensus on what's the best way to work on to figure out interest expense for banks and other types of permanent establishments. The court asked a couple of questions about post-treaty interpretation, and while the proper focus is on 1975 when the treaty was signed leading up to the ratification, the case law is clear that post-treaty materials, I think this is in the O'Connor Supreme Court case and in Stewart, can shed light on what the party's expectations were, and that's why recent OECD and UK adoption of its new law, which don't purport to change the separate enterprise principle but do express permissible methods for implementing it, are relevant in this case. Our briefs make this clear, but I just want to correct something that I thought counsel said, is that the regulation does not disregard interbranch loans that are actually used to create third-party assets. It will give credit for those interbranch loans up to 95%. And finally, the branch is not an independent entity. It is relying on the worldwide capital of the bank, which is why the branch books do in fact need to be adjusted. And unless the court has any further questions, yes, the court will be
answered. The 95% rule, though, is one which takes into account the capital requirement, doesn't it?
It takes into account that a branch operating as a separate entity would have some capital.
Some capital.
It's a very conservative number, frankly.
Thank you, Ms. Abbott. Thank both counsel for a well-argued case.